Welcome to Polycast, the civilization podcast focused on game strategy. Dan Q.
Makalua.
The Vian Team.
Ed Jin.
With guest co-hosts.
Canuck Soldier.
Dragon Petrox.
Travis HWA.
For me, I'm looking forward to playing the Shoshone. Is it Shoshone? They need like a pronunciation guide for us. So
yeah, I believe it is.
Thankfully, the announcer, the narrator, tells us when we're playing the Civ.
Yeah, Shoshone. Greetings, listeners. Welcome to episode 176. I'm the Me and Team, and I'm joined by fellow co-host Dan Q.
Our house in the middle of our house.
Makalua.
Ah.
We are also joined by guest co-hosts John.
Hi, everyone.
Petrox.
Hi-yo.
Travis.
Hi.
And Brad.
Hi, everybody.
So we've got a full house going on here.
Do you remember, Brad, when I interviewed you as part of a game developer series for a Polton Civilization site?
Oh, absolutely.
Talked about Galactic Civilizations 2, and I remember it was the first time I ever talked to anyone and recorded them, and I was using different software. I won't mention the name of the software. It was absolutely brutal.
And we went through the Master Orion 3 release together. Remember that? That was something.
We all remember that.
How diplomatic of you, which is a victory condition in Civilization 5. See how we all tied that back together?
I was about to say, when you said about the software, Dan has won a diplomatic victory again.
He's Canadian. It's their special ability.
What would the Canadian special unit be? That's what I want to know.
Come on, that's an easy one.
The obvious one would be the Mounties, right?
Yes. You'd have the hockey wonder.
There you go.
Oh.
Yes, no stereotypes here at all.
Nope, none whatsoever.
No, there are no stereotypes allowed on the show, eh?
So we have two new civs that have been announced recently. First, we have Enrico Danilo, the 42nd Doge of Venice. I'm probably pronouncing that wrong, but no one here has been around when he was alive anyway. And we have
all eight male.
I would be if coincidence shares that name, I'd be quite pissed off.
And, of course, we have Chief Pacoletto, the leader of the Bantok Shoshone tribe representing North American Aboriginal people.
I was absolutely fascinated that 2K decided to announce this just on their Facebook page. I will save my Facebook-only revealing information through official channels for another show. But they didn't say anything in the post about what their unique ability is, what their unique unit is. Do they have a unique tile improvement? Do they have a unique whatever else? And instead, that came about through a number of articles on to interwebs. We specifically looking at the one from PC Gamer, which not only includes what those abilities are, but apparently someone is telling us how to play these civilizations already.
Yeah, I'm sure that's just full of in-depth strategy, too.
Definitely in-depth.
I think
not really in-depth, but it's kind of common sense by looking at the tools they're given. Although the one feels kind of gimmicky to me. Like, it doesn't really seem effective. It just seems like they were brainstorming, okay, like, we have 50 million of these things now. What can we give these guys?
Yeah, Venice just sort of seems like a city-state on steroids, really. But, well, we haven't played it yet, so who knows.
I like Venice, though, but I played that old game, The Prince, where you could buy cardinals and assassinate people, so maybe I'm biased because of it.
I don't necessarily dislike it, but I don't really see it shaping my general strategy. I mean, obviously it would affect it because you're bidded from expanding, but I don't know. I
like
think
this?
I would still just...
Four-city tradition opener? Nope.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure this Civ will never be played in MP, but, you know, you know, unless you're the last guy in.
Venice can neither build nor capture settlers, and they can never annex conquered cities, so essentially that says puppet empire. And they also, I believe, get additional trade routes. Disagree with you about multiplayer. In my experience, gold seems to multiplayer. It's who can span the most units, so it seems kind of useful to me, especially if you have a puppet empire.
Well, the thing is, though, like, where are you going to build them? Pretty much in Venice. You're not going to be able to hammer out a lot of stuff in your other cities regardless. But yeah, I mean, that's potentially viable. My only concern in multiplayer is who you're conquering the cities from in the first place to get all those trade routes.
True, but I don't think it works the same way as it does currently.
Granted, but the last thing I would want to do if somebody good has their hands on Venice is let them farm out a whole bunch of trade routes and buy units. Like, I would do anything it would take. Pillaging roads, attacking their stuff so they can't really build them.
Isn't it, like, based on a caravan, if I'm not mistaken? Like, you build a caravan, send it to the city-state, and that builds the trade route? Isn't
that
going to
have a hard time doing that without a road and with enemy military units there.
You can establish a trade route with the city-state. You can also establish a trade route with cities from other civilizations, and you can also have internal trade as well. And depending upon the type of trade route you establish, that first and foremost will decide in part what kind of trade that's going to be. Trade routes, Venice is going to get double the number. And from previous previews, it seemed to suggest that you would get 7 or 8 trade routes by the end of the game. So if you got yourself into the modern era, so you can just take that number and double it for Venice. Wow.
Yeah, we'll wait and see.
Well, knowing that gold has been taken away substantially from the map, like off the coast, for example, and off of rivers, the ability to actually get some money coming in, plus the fact that we talked about the last episode or the episode before, how unless you are friends with another civilization, you cannot get a lump sum of gold up front. You could only get gold per turn. So these things combined, it's kind of very powerful.
Oh, that is a good change.
The double trade routes, you can decide on balance, and I think we all have to play it to realize it, whether or not the fact that you can never build or capture settlers or you can never annex conquered cities, it kind of reminds me of when Civ 5 first came out and you would just have this massive puppet empire and you would use the puppet empire to essentially fund
trading post spam
your continued war efforts. So
based on the way this is showing, unless the Diplo victory changes considerably, Venice really would be pretty solid for it. The article mentions it. The fact that you can buy away like a lot of the people who would vote against you and lower the number of votes, that's interesting. You can definitely ruin other people's Diplo wins, too.
The thing that also reminds me of Venice itself is India. It's just like India is coupled with a drawback that has a bonus with it. Now, given Venice, this sounds a lot better on paper. The thing I didn't like about India was the inflexibility of that bonus, that basically you were committed, like even on paper, even when I first knew about it, encouraged to go for a small empire. But the fact of the matter is, most decent things can be pretty flexible. And that's what I tend to find, that flexibility is a key thing, and taking that away can not be not so good. So Venice being unable to settle, it's like you see a good city site, oh, tough luck, someone else is going to have to settle it before you can get it yourself.
Interesting example, though, and Majin pointed this out, I forget whether it was last episode or the episode before, once your city grows to a certain size, it's actually just a net happiness benefit, because that winds up being functionally global happiness beyond the cap of the city because of it.
And that's why I find the Shoshone a much more interesting civilization, especially in multiplayer. That's been my new favorite civ.
Yeah, I think the Shoshone looks very powerful in the early game, especially.
Instead of having a scout, they have the Pathfinder. The problem with the scout is that he dies so easily. So when he goes and finds barbarians, he's quickly killed. It's like having a warrior that moves as fast as a scout, so he can find stuff really quick. And then on top of that, they make no bones about what this civilization's about. It's the land grab. And so then when you found a new city, it already starts with extra territory around it. So
that you can pick your bonus from ruins.
Yes.
It's not so lucky
hut. That's the biggest thing for me, yeah.
It's the deterministic hut. Interesting.
Oh, yeah. I didn't get to that. So then you get to a ruins, and everyone else just gets a random one, but these guys get to pick it, right? So in a multiplayer game, you know, unless you're playing against other people who are really good at it, in this game, you're going to have a huge advantage, because a lot of times it's who got the best start, and these guys always are going to have the best start.
Yep, they certainly are.
I think there's going to be a lot of complaining about this particular civ. It's going to probably need to be balanced a little bit.
Sony will have to be playtested, especially in MP. It could be very powerful.
It could be. I mean, they also talk about with the Shoshone that the unique unit, Comanche Raiders, a cheaper, faster alternative to cavalry, according to TJ Haffer, who is a reporter for PC Gamer. The thing about the Shoshone, though, when he describes, I also highly recommend grabbing the religious tenet that gives you bonus faith for whatever type of land tile is most common in your start location. Since you'll have so much land so early, you should be able to dominate the religious game. And that, to me, assumes that you can take a pantheon that will give you faith for working a tile, that you actually have that tile. Now, because they get more territory right from the start, yes, you're going to be able to take advantage of even more than, say, America with their cheaper ability to buy tiles, that you're going to be able to work those more quickly, assuming, of course, you also remember to go get the technology that, say, allows you to put the the plantation down on there, for instance. But I don't necessarily agree that you're going to be able to dominate the religious game for that. Whereas when he talks about Venice saying diplomatic seems to be the way to go, ally yourself to as many city-states as possible and buy out the ones that ally with your political rivals, it's all game-dependent, of course. Even with Venice, although I can certainly see the diplomatic route, I'd like to try just having this huge puppeted empire and continue to go on the rampage, because as ECAT points out in the chat, you can purchase units in your puppets. And he also mentions that the need to generate the merchants as well, that they are the great merchant replacement. That's true. However, you do get one for free when you research the optics technology.
Probably going to want to go for anyway because of the great galleuses. I think the normal galleus is pretty good. Bigger and stronger? Yes, please.
And that can help you protect your trade routes, and you have the potential to get double those trade routes. And we know that trade routes by ocean are more lucrative than they are going to be by land.
Yeah, it's just I'm more thinking about rampaging with the galleys of our naval cities.
I understand TJ's argument on PC Gamer about the diplomatic route, and even though I and some other people here are thinking more about the militaristic route, that just goes to show that it's not, okay, if you're playing this Civ, then you must try to accomplish this. This must be your mindset from the beginning, and if you can't do that, well, you can mull along, but forget about trying to be able to shift gears, because I think if you initially went in with the thought, I'm going to try the militaristic route, and then you realize, oh, there's an even bigger bully than I am on the map, maybe I can shift tactics and start getting in good favors with city-states and then buying them out and bringing them into my empire.
No, it's always about space for me.
Yeah, I appreciate that as someone who likes the space-based civilization games, that you like space. I think that these two civilizations allow players who really are kind of at the extremes, and that's what I like about them, is that you have one that if you want to be the puppet master, I mean, Venice is, really lends itself to that. And if you like to be the super expansionist, then is the one for you. And I think that really speaks to where this period has gone. Like, you've had Civilization V, which when it first came out, there was a little bit of controversy about it. A lot of people don't know that. Take-Two moved the original release date back by like 6 months. There were a lot of things I think they wanted to have in there that weren't, or things that weren't play tested as well as they wanted, but they kind of polished it up with first expansion pack. I think this one, I think Brave New World, now adds in all the things that I think, and I haven't played it, may satisfy those Civilization IV fans who felt that Civilization V had taken away too much.
I agree.
Phil and I here, I think you may be mistaken.
Yeah, you're getting trade routes back, you're getting ideologies in here. The World Congress part really improves things. Cultural victory has been improved. I mean, it's a lot deeper. Brave New World has been designed for, I think, the hardcore more so than the first expansion, certainly more than the original.
I think it's a pretty fair statement.
And I've seen some people have said, oh, no, like more of the same. Oh, I didn't like Gods and Kings. Oh, Brave New World isn't fixing anything. It's making things worse.
I pretty much think that haters are going to hate in all things, and that people tend to forget, and they seem to want to compare End of the Line, Beyond the Sword to Vanilla Civ 5, or even with the current expansion. It's not there yet. Like, the game laid fundamentals, and it's been building upon them, and I'm optimistic for the expansion. Like, I think what they're adding is interesting, and really it's going to make the game that much better.
I think if you didn't like the direction of Gods and Kings, even if you liked Vanilla Civ 5, although I have yet to come across someone who said that they actually preferred Vanilla Civ 5 over Gods and Kings. But if you're not liking Gods and Kings, I don't see you liking Brave New World, because it doesn't take away anything from Gods and Kings. And in fact, some things that were in Gods and Kings, you're now going to be able to get in Brave New World. Religion isn't going away. Espionage isn't going away.
Yeah, but I consider those things to be good things. I mean, you had all those things in Civilization IV. The number one thing I didn't like about Civ V over Civ IV is I really like Ultra Conquest element, that I could take over other cities. I know that...
tourism, that was how that was done.
That's to be the offensive culture,
yes,
while your social policies are tended to be the defensive culture. And I think because that there's then that dynamic, for someone like me who prefers to be a little more aggressive in the game, then I don't feel like, well, if I want to play the culture game, then I need to sit here. I need to, you know, go through and unlock 5 social policy trees in order to be able to build the Utopia project.
Yes.
And I just hope I'm back here and I don't want to interact with anybody else. And it's just very, very, very passive and very boring to me.
Very dull, yeah.
Yeah, I agree.
When I play Minecraft, I like to build. I don't like to fight other people. But when I play Civilization, I like to get aggressive.
Yeah, Dan wants some people to punch.
Civ 4, at least you control other people's cities. Sistine Chapel, Ben.
That was the part of Civilization 5 I didn't like, is I felt like I couldn't win the game through culture. And it looks like through the tourism mechanism, you're going to be able to do that again. So that's why I'm saying that more so than Gods and Kings, I really think Brave New World is going to be something that would satisfy the Civilization 4 community more so than what we've seen so far with Civilization 5.
I think in terms of depth, you're right.
Yeah.
Overall, the majority of what I've seen publicly in response to Brave New World is positive, and the positive tone is also a little cautious because there was lots of positive feelings in lead up to Civilization 5, and we talked about some of the concerns and disappointments that were raised and have also been addressed, at least in part. And understandably, some people have been saying, what's changing in multiplayer? You really haven't talked about multiplayer. You've been saying for some time you're going to address these issues because you have acknowledged them. And perhaps it's just, for better or worse, they're really not talking about them because it's not going to get as much press as, hey, look, new civilizations.
They're not talking about it because it's not a priority. They don't care. I mean, even, okay, let me put that another way. To be brutally fair, even in games that are designed for multiplayer, like, for example, using a random example, I know, Age of Empires 3, that was a game I was quite heavily involved in. As much as the multiplayer and the balance of all that mattered, it's just like, it was surprising for me to learn, at least, that 90% of the players who played that game played it single player rather than multiplayer. I mean, sure, I'd think it was majority, but 90%? Civ is even more single player orientated than what AoE 3 is, so... I don't know. I don't know what to make of that.
Your marketing becomes the numbers game.
I know on Civilization 4, I think it was like only 3% of the user base even tried multiplayer.
Yeah. Wow. Well, it doesn't surprise me. I thought it would be less, actually.
I didn't say they actually played a game through. I mean, they even tried it.
I know what you mean. I know what you're getting at. I still think it would be less than that. That doesn't excuse it not working. I mean, or rather being a bit iffy in function and stuff like that. And that's why I really liked Civ 4's design about being designed from a multiplayer perspective from the ground up, even though 97% of its players will never click the multiplayer button.
Well, another reason it helps is that you just tend to get better balanced mechanics when you design around a multiplayer perspective.
Yes.
Not to mention it focuses some AI choices better, not because you make the programming for the AI better, but just because you become more aware of certain things than you might have otherwise.
Balancing for MP is never a bad thing for SP, for sure. The converse is not always true, though.
It's never true. Civ 5, case in point.
In fact, with games with so many Civ options or faction options, it doesn't even really matter what game it is. If you balance around single player and then go into multiplayer with a ton of options like that, you are guaranteed to find some pretty questionable things cropping up. That's just how it is.
I think it's reasonable to say that once Brave New World comes out, hopefully multiplayer, Civ 5, because it's a different platform, like we're using Steam instead of GameSpy, but to be able to say that, okay, I'm satisfied enough with the way Civilization 5 multiplayer works, even if it's not as good or not as bad as previous Civ games, as a result of the second expansion pack being released, to be kind of analogous to when Beyond the Sword was released, which was the second expansion pack for Civilization 4, that multiplayer is as far along as it will be in Brave New World as it was in Beyond the Sword.
I'm going to go with no.
I hope so. I mean, it certainly has improved since Vanilla.
I hope so too, but I'm going to go with no.
It has, and they have mentioned unspecified MP improvements as well as things like Pit Boss. However, I share the pessimism. I think if you're building on a house of cards, there's only so much you can do. I'm optimistic that it'll be better than it is now, hopefully a little more stable, and, you know, we'll be able to play larger games, but I guess we'll just have to wait and see. I don't want to be, openly bitter about Civ 5 MP, but it certainly didn't leave the gate very well.
Yeah. I was getting a little frustrated in the weekly games with Civ 5 before Gods and Kings. We'd actually gone back to playing Civ 4.
Yeah, I was actually surprised the first time I was on this show and, like, half the people, like, didn't even play Civ 5. I'm just like, really? That's kind of crazy.
It's gone a long way since then.
ECAT says in the chat, I feel like Gods and Kings was what vanilla should have been.
You do not want to get me or Phil too much involved in what vanilla should have been.
Although, you're just going to run into the thing that it's not like the previous Civ iteration, so some people aren't going to like it for that reason. But in terms of depth from vanilla to what now Brave New World is showing us, it really does have a lot more depth. But for people like me, I'm kind of out of luck. Like, I don't have a problem with Civ 5 in most of its design. I mean, okay, it's got some flaws, but you know, we all know Civ 4 has plenty of flaws, too. But for me, it's just so slow, and it makes it unplayable after a while because you give an order and you have to wait so much.
Most of it comes down to the pathfinding for the AI. It may not seem like it, but city-states actually add a lot to the turn time. If you want to reduce your turn time, reduce the number of city-states. I know it doesn't seem intuitive. I've talked to them about this because, you know, I write AI, and there's always a debate in AI corners. Mm. Do you put AI logic in your pathfinding? I never do. Now, maybe I should, but Civ 5 does. Every time a unit is doing its pathfinding check, it's going through and looking at all the different things that might happen as it's going down that path.
And there is why, for example, hey, I gave the worker an order to build a plantation or to go over to that tile. Why are you prompting me for orders now? You said you were going to take 3 turns, and then you realize, oh, there's a barbarian in the vicinity.
It's 6 freaking hexes away. Oh my god, barbarian.
They're probably overcompensating for what they did in Civ 4, where like you could set waypoints after producing a unit. Your unit would move out of the city right adjacent to an enemy unit, clearly in view. You'd lose that unit then. There'd be nothing you could do about it.
The irony is that because it's always calling wolf, and you're going, it's nothing, when there actually is a threat, you may overlook it, because you keep dismissing all the times it calls wolf.
Yeah, well, it's like that's not it in itself. I'm talking about overall. I'm talking about the AI is trying to decide, well, is this a good point? Am I putting myself too much in danger? And so you end up with, in theory, a stronger AI. Now, in like Galactic Civilizations, I cheaped out. What I did is I had another thread. So I had a background smatter occasionally looking at where the AI was moving. And if it happened to, by luck almost, see that the AI was getting into trouble, then it would actually call it and abort it. The downside is that it's not as smart as the Civ 5 AI is at moving its units.
Oh, good God. Please tell me you did not call the Civ 5 AI smart. Please tell me that.
He didn't. I'm not talking about that the other AI isn't as.
No, the Civ 5 AI, when it's actually in the process of moving, it's better at keeping itself out of danger. My view is that what wins games is not that tactical movement of each and every unit. It's this overall strategy of doing things. Now, I will say, I don't know if you noticed, they did improve the AI massively in some of the last updates. Some of the guys there, I had time to sit down and just play it and play it and play it. People were on Civ Fanatics listening to the strategies, and they did implement a lot of that stuff into some of the more recent Civ 5 patches. So you should notice a pretty significant improvement, post Gods and Kings.
So should those changes be in effect now? Like,
I only know when they were checked in. I don't know if they've been released. When people say AI, they use the word very broadly when there's really lots and lots of AI going on, right? You have the AI in terms of picking a good place to go, but then you have the AI of, should I even be trying to go there in the first place? And Soren wrote that AI, and that's one of the big differences. Actually, I just talked to Soren a couple weeks ago about this, and this is a big mistake I made in the Elemental game, Fallen Enchantress in particular. In Civ 4, Soren, just not only the designer, but he wrote the AI and he wrote what are called the worker functions. And those are the functions the AI queries and asks questions of, is this a good place to go? Or what is the best thing I should wear? Or what is the best unit I should build? And I went, oh, these are pretty easy functions. I would just have one of the guys write them. And then it turned out there was a lot of disconnect. And you end up with some really bad AI. You're calling a function that's returning bad data. And I think in Civ 4, the AI is actually pretty good because Soren did both the AI and the worker functions.
Now, how come he didn't have human automated workers function like AI automated workers when it comes to detecting trouble? That really frustrates me. Your workers will suicide at war. But the AI workers never do this. You never see, like, an AI worker just sitting on a border making a tile improvement and letting your unit snipe them.
Yeah, that's a different issue entirely. Because that's one's AI, right? AI player, strategic layer, and the other one's more like a unit AI level thing.
Yeah, it's like an intellectual AI versus a procedural AI. Like Brad is getting at, how do I move over here because I've been ordered to move over here versus should I move over there at all? Which, for the human player, we want the AI to respond to our command. We want to be able to input the command in a reasonable fashion, and then we want the AI to implement that. Like, if we say we want you to go to this tile, it's going to show you, if it's going to take multiple turns, this is the path that we think that it should take. You could decide to change that. No, rather than automating those three or four turns, I want you to go here. I will then choose the next two or three turns afterwards, as opposed to the AI, which itself would then have to decide, am I going to move that unit over here in the first place? And the AI's ability to first decide, is it important for me now, if ever, to in fact move this particular unit over here, versus then, okay, what's the best way for it to get over here?
That's what I'm talking about, though, the latter part. And that should be the same between AI workers and human automated workers. In other words, if you just click on a worker and hit the A button for automate, and they just build improvements on their own forever until you interrupt them, it should perform pretty similarly in terms of the quote-unquote, should I move on to this tile, as an AI worker would.
Even RTSs, someone's sitting there killing your peons while they're picking berries or whatever, and you go, why won't they move? They're just, the guy next to me just got slaughtered. And then you get into discussions of what should be in the unit AI versus what should be in a strategic AI. And in Civ 4, the decision was made that moving your workers out of peril should be a strategic AI choice. And
how about not moving your workers into peril against your will before you can interrupt it?
Again, I know exactly what I'm saying. I'm just saying why it happened.
Yeah.
With the benefit of 5-6 years of hindsight, we can now say it shouldn't have been done that way.
It's just going along with automating your workers, though. If you automate your workers, that's what you get. Why you shouldn't automate your workers.
I agree, but at the same time, you're putting in a feature in the game that ultimately isn't usable. So why provide automated workers at all if they're so non-functional that they suicide?
I don't think the AI workers
I think they're two different AIs. Blip did the BTS AI, I know, and I think that is the AI that the workers use, whereas the workers in vanilla, the human workers use a bit of the old AI. I'm guessing.
It's a different function entirely.
I don't think the AI players' workers are on any automated thing. I think the AI is manually, from its perspective, moving its workers, because it
that
doesn't
makes more sense, actually. Yeah.
Yeah.
But I definitely think Soren did a job of writing the AI. He worked a lot with the MP team at the time and determining, you know, how would we do it, and tried to implement that as best you could without acquiring Big Blue to run Civ. Yeah.
That's the thing I like about Civ 4 as a whole. Its design was designed as around being a multiplayer game. Civ 5 didn't do that, and I think it suffered a little bit because of it.
I think it did, too. I think if you designed it in parallel, SP and MP at the same time, like basically Soren did that both sides benefit. And I think Civ 5 was strictly an SP game with MP tacked on at the end, and not very well, to be brutally honest.
There are some reasons for that most people aren't aware of. And in Civ 5, they didn't have any programmers on it for the longest time during development. A lot of them were on XCOM and a whole bunch of other stuff that was going on. And so it was, from a programmatic, number of engineering hours on Civ 5 was nothing compared to what Civ 4 had going for it.
Yeah, and I'm pretty sure the decision to go from GameSpy to Steam happened at the most inopportune time and affected the development as well, too.
Oh, it's more than that. I mean, like, remember right before Civ 5 shipped, they laid off a bunch of people at Firaxis?
Yes, I remember.
Well, they laid off networking people, and
yeah, well done,
and so they had to call people off from XCOM to work on the networking because that stuff wasn't done.
Yeah, but they made the brave statement to the public that none of the layoffs would affect development either. I remember that, too.
I'm not very impressed with some of the project management decisions made throughout that project. That's
no.
Well, remember, that a lot of that stuff is happening at the Praxis. Those were all Take-Two calls.
Oh, no doubt at all.
As an aside to interject, there might be some people listening to this and are wondering, Brad mentioned about programming AI. And Brad, why do you talk about programming AI, and what do you know about space-based civilization-type games?
I'm the designer of Galactic Civilizations, and I programmed AI on that. And then most recently, I wrote the AI for Fallen Chantress and in Legendary Heroes.
I'm really fascinated with AI. Tried programming a handful of times, but I just don't have the mind for it.
We had a game designer fest at my house a couple weeks ago. Some kind of stuff we talked about.
How much is it really a trade-off between the way you set it up for the near-instant turn times and the longer turn times where AI is trying to use better strategy for each of its unit movements?
I personally prefer my way. I don't allow AI to be put into pathfinding because I want to have control over that. What the user will see is that my AI will be much more prone to someone being able to put something in between. Like if I'm trying to go from point A to point B, a player could potentially put something in between those two points and be able to whack the player as he gets through.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing it prevents me from being able to do is Civ 5 is, you know how you have territory and the AI isn't allowed to enter it without a treaty?
Yeah.
It's basically impossible for me to write AI that keeps AI from coming into your territory. You know, we have to kick you out of the territory thing, which some people don't like, which for a good reason because it can be annoying. But the only way, otherwise AI would constantly get bottlenecked and not be able to get anywhere because you wouldn't be able to get to point B without checking every single tile in between to make sure that there isn't a own piece of territory in between.
Hmm.
If they don't have a non-aggression pact with you, the AI will never walk into your territory, no matter what. And I can't do that in the way my AI is written because I can't check the tiles in between that are on the way to point B.
I see.
To that degree.
Now, does it have like an auto-interrupt if an enemy does get into the path, makes a new choice?
Not during the pathfinding part of it, when it's actually walking.
I see.
Part. It'll look around and say, oh, well, there's a monster here. I will go and do something else.
But it wouldn't be able to tell there was a monster there normally anyway, right, because of the fog of war.
Well, I mean, even if he could see.
Oh, okay.
Huh. I think it's made worse in Civ 5 because we have the one unit per tile mechanism, so you're pathfinding a lot of units each turn. You can say bad things about Civ 4 stack combat.
The AI looks like it's moving the units individually, even in stacks, which is kind of frustrating. But
well, when John came to Stardock, I talked about that. And I said, you know, if you had come up with that at Stardock, we would have vetoed that. Because I always said, you have to come up with a way to come up with the pathfinding when you have that one type, you know, unit per tile thing. Because that's going to be a monster to fix. We just wouldn't allow it.
Yeah.
Just even from a human's gameplay standpoint, it's a pain in the neck. It's just like you're trying to negotiate a city-state, and you've got a little, what do you call it, a little peninsula or something, and there's units blocking you, moving your great prophet from spreading the religion. It's like, I'm not trying to do anything. I mean, never mind for AIs trying to do the same. Jeez.
Yeah, it just makes the whole thing a lot tougher to do.
I still think just aren't enough hexes. Like, yes. There's too little space between cities, and units take up too much space, essentially.
Yeah, and they figured out that six tiles is basically the maximum you want cities to tend to be away from each other before it affects the pacing.
I mean, I wouldn't have minded scaling the game such that you have way more hexes and then giving units more movement. You just have more mobility then.
That's true.
But keeping your production scale the same. Because then a lot of these logjam issues are less serious. I mean, it's not like they wouldn't happen, but they'd happen much less frequently.
Yeah, well, that was essentially our solution. Every unit gets two moves.
Oh, yeah, and that did happen in Civ 5 as well. But I think you could even go further with it. If you're really looking for a one unit per hex model, especially with zone of control also a factor.
The pathfinding would be even nastier.
Civ 5 has zone of control.
The longer your pathfinding tree is, it gets exponentially more expensive.
Yeah.
Yeah, I had this conversation with other MP players, and basically every successful one-unit per tile game have all been tactical level games, you know, like Panzer General. Problems you deal with in a tactical level game are quite different than a strategic level game that's Civ. And I don't think we ever got the one-unit per tile system right in a strategic level game.
The people who argue for one unit per tile and saying stack combat was too easy and too boring, that was primarily because the AI couldn't play the game anymore in Civ 4. It's like, you do that to another human, you will get absolutely massacred, as Phil would gladly tell you.
Oh my gosh, there was a guy in our Turncast, this is like well over a year ago now, I think it's closer to 2 years ago. He basically got destroyed by an AI, so rejoined in as the AI, and refused to give me a city that I'd really been targeting all game. So I decided I was just going to culture flip it, but he didn't like this, of course, because I was taunting him a little bit. And I admit I was trying to bait him into attacking me, and he certainly did. So this guy declares on me, and maybe I'm like 75% of his power, or maybe not quite. And because he moved his stack into my territory like that, he was dead by like 10, 15 turns. I'd taken every single one of his cities, even though he's significantly stronger than me. You don't want to screw around with that. But that's how the AI moves into your borders, too. And if, you know, the only reason it's even challenging at all and so far is the bonuses. Because otherwise you could just stack wipe it like nothing and it wouldn't be able to reproduce anything in time. You just kill all of its
and
cities.
The thing that gets me the most, the AI in Civ 5 is much worse.
I don't know. I don't know that you can say that with certainty.
I can.
Because the tactical demands in Civ 5 are a little bit higher.
To do the AI in Civ 5 is a lot tougher than Civ 4.
Civ 4 had some tactical elements that 5 lacks and vice versa. I would say Civ 5 has a little bit more demand there than 4, but not as much as people claim.
No.
Knowing history behind Civ 5's Brave New World, and this comes to us from Polygon by Russ Pitts, a feature editor who, according to his profile, is a Capricorn, loves dogs, and shoots guns. Yikes. He says that the Civilization series has, for over 20 years, defined strategy gaming. And I just sat there and I read that and I kind of basked in my all-knowingness this already. I didn't need to read it from Russ, but it's nice to see that it is being acknowledged by other people. The first thing that is talked about in this article is why the number 9, specifically why are there 9 new civilizations in Brave New World? And the short answer was because, well, that's how many we put in Gods and Kings, so we didn't want to put in any more or any less. We wanted to be consistent with the previous Civilization V expansion. And apparently there was there was also a practical reason. There's something called a production budget, how much work was going to have to go into developing each civilization, and, of course, a timeline to go along with the budget as well, no less. But I think as much as we can talk about the entire article, and we're going to do that to some degree, the people that they talked to from Firaxis, which was producer Dennis Shirk, they also talked to Ed Beach, the lead designer on Brave New World, as he was for Gods and Kings, as well as a couple of other people involved in the Brave New World development. They asked themselves 3 questions. Where haven't we gone? Where do people want us to go? And what can we do that's fun? And as applied to civilizations, Beach rephrases that as, how can we take a Civ and make it into an interesting gameplay experience? The answer to the first question is you check off a list. Where haven't we gone? Which is probably why we see some more African civilizations, for example, between the scenarios and the base game as well. To answer the second question, the team turned to its forum community, Civ Fanatics, which I thought was interesting. Don't worry about the 2K forums or Polton or We Play Civ or Civ Players or the German Civ Forum. It's only Civ Fanatics. I enjoyed the part about that the forum community determined that a list of unannounced achievements was in alphabetical order and so determined what letters the unannounced civilization started with, which apparently frustrated Firaxis that we figured this out. Don't underestimate the intelligence of the Civ community and our ability to look into the minutiae of everything, like why this pixel is colored this way. Hey, we've talked about before on this show that people debate what color city-states should be, and also the shades of colors.
Bust out Excel spreadsheets to optimize their micro. It really shouldn't surprise anybody that they pick up on details when they're really interested in a topic.
We're pretty good at reverse engineering the whole game, for sure.
Absolutely. Once the designers settle on the civs, the art team steps in. Apparently, scenes with leaders and diplomacy are easily the most graphically intensive parts of the game. Really? The next step involves a lot of research and some creative decision-making. Scour the internet looking for clues. For instance, if we want to include a civilization and there are no photographs, or can we even find drawings of what people look like, what clothing look like, what building looks like, how are we going to be able to include this appropriately in the game? They consult a historical text, and my favorite part, occasionally as a last resort, they also turn to cosplayers.
Well, some cosplayers are very detail-oriented, so...
This is true. As long as you're being as selective about what cosplayers you look at, I think in context, that's fair to say. But
Don't go to the anime convention is what you're saying?
Well, even there, you can get, like, 1 appropriate a person out of 10, at least.
Depends on why you're going to those conventions, Mackie.
Don't worry, we won't judge Mackie.
No, we won't.
I'm judging.
I'm just going by pictures. I have never been at a convention, just for everyone to know.
Uh-huh.
We can tell the disappointment in your voice that you've never been to one once.
Yeah, right.
I can tell the sincerity.
Firaxis conducts multiple rounds of playtesting with new features in Civs, but the challenge it faced with the new Civs in Brave New World was teaching the playtesters how to approach them before they could test them out. The final proof, says Shirk, will be how well it plays in the hands of the fans. Because we know that regardless of how much playtesting is done, and that certainly has an impact just to the degree to which developers and publishers respond to that feedback, when you have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people playing your game, as opposed to, well, dozens perhaps, other things are going to crop up. But you want to be able to feel like this should have been reasonably anticipated before the game has been released. But I like the teaching playtesters how to approach them, because there have been so many knee-jerk reactions, tying it back to our earlier topic, about Venice. Venice is a city-state. It's not a Civ, therefore it's not appropriate.
Venice was super powerful in its time, so shut up.
Or the more practical, which is, well, you can't possibly win. What's the point? You just need to be a one-city challenge with Venice. There's no other way to win. There's no other way to win. This is really hindering. I think as soon as you tell someone to change the way you think about playing the game, then it's a defensive reaction because you don't know. And there are a lot of things that we don't know. Plus the fact that when we're getting the information about what the unique abilities are from sources other than 2K or Firaxis, and inevitably in the language and in the wording choice, like it talks about a stronger cavalry, for example, for the Shoshone. Well, what does that really mean? We don't know. We don't know the particular stats on that, just like we haven't had a chance to play it yet. Ed Beach says, if you look at Civ 4, it's still getting played. Civ 3 is still getting played. Part of the strength of the community is the way that, even once we wrap up working on one, they know it's going to have been brought forward over many years of gestation, and it's going to be in a really solid place. Fans are going to be happy sitting with Civ 5 for a couple of years until the next one is ready to roll out. And I'm thinking, you do realize that people are going to pounce all over that wording, right?
They've sold well every time. Why wouldn't they make another game?
I'm pretty sure there's another expansion coming.
There what?
Will be more. I'm pretty sure there will be expansions after Brave New World to Civ 5.
Mm-hmm. Even as compared to, say, more downloadable content? I mean, yes, okay, some people are like, but Dan, Civ 5 is also downloadable content. Yes, I know, but the quote-unquote piecemeal downloadable content as compared to your full downloadable content that is an expansion pack.
I'm pretty sure you'll see another Civilization 5 clone something before Take-Two's end of fiscal year, October 31st of 2014.
What?
Oof. I'm not privy to anything internally at Firaxis.
I know Gods and Kings obviously made more money than they expected, and that's why we've got Brave New World coming out, because obviously it's a good profit model, apparently.
With regards to Sid Meier, who's the father of it all, I know in my case, it was the original Civilization that inspired me to become a game developer in the first place. And
jeez, I'm jelly.
What's that?
Game developer. Listen to you in mind.
Yeah. I mean, in my case, I was in college studying to be an electrical engineer, and I was playing Civilization, and I was on Usenet, and we were all complaining that, what happens after the spaceship leaves? And they're like, they should make another game. And being the naive person I was certainly about naming, I said, well, I'll make one. How hard can it be? I'll call it, I don't know, Space Civilization. Hello, Galactic Civilizations. Sure, that's what we'll call it. And that's where Galactic Civilizations was inspired by, was what would happen to your colony ship after it left Earth. And, of course, later on they made Alpha Centauri, which was a little bit more their definitive post-release. But you know, Sid Meier, actually, this is back in the early 90s. Civilization 1 was released in, I think, 1991, is that right?
The original Civ for the PC from Sid, yep.
And then after he did that, he went on and he worked on things like Pirates, which was another amazing game. And I remember at the time, you think, how can one guy come up with all the best games, right? There's all these people, everyone wants to make games, but this one person keeps making all the best games. And then he teamed up with Brian Reynolds, who worked on Civilization 2. And Civilization 3, and a lot of people don't know this, but Civilization 3, it was essentially used the same code base as Alpha Centauri. In a way, Civilization 3 was a mod of Alpha Centauri back in the day. Even today, so Sid Meier, he worked on Civilization Revolution. I mean, my understanding is he actually programmed it.
That's correct.
And he still does a great deal of the programming at Firaxis. He has his own set of game libraries that he programs the games in, and then he has a team that takes it and essentially ports it to different platforms.
He's not the director of creative development of Firaxis for nothing.
Yeah, I mean, and supposedly there's a gajillion number of unreleased prototypes sitting, you know, on his computers.
Dinosaurs.
Yeah, I knew Dan was way more than
that. I've had people work with him have told me that if he has an idea, he can go home on a Friday and come in on a Monday and show you a fully playable prototype. Because he has literally 20 years worth of these gameplay libraries he's built, and he can just quickly throw things together and get stuff on screen.
His latest programming effort is Ace Patrol for the iOS.
Yeah, so since we're in Civ Revolution, he seems to be quite a fan of the mobile platforms, because PC games have started to require a level of sophistication that can be a bit of a turnoff if you're a game designer, because there has to be just so much stuff in them. The games that we love from late 80s or early 90s could never be made today as they were. I mean, we talk about games like Civilization 1. It's less complex than Civ Revolution in many ways. Ace Patrol would have been a great PC game back in the early 90s. And so you can go and make those kind of old-school games, but for mobile. And I think Ace Patrol is really a great example that you can come up with new game designs on a mobile platform.
I think you can find, with regards to PC gaming, so long as there is depth, as long as there is either a story to the game or it's kind of like an open sandbox, I'm thinking about Minecraft here specifically, you don't have to be spending like AAA budgets into how it looks necessarily, and certainly with the cachet that Sid's name brings, that if he put something out there that perhaps someone else did but it didn't look particularly polished, it looked like it came from the 90s, for example, that people wouldn't necessarily as much attention to it. But I know he talked about, with Ace Patrol, being able to really focus on the gameplay and felt comfortable encoding it and being able to go kind of back to, in a way like he was doing with Civilization Revolution, where it was, here's Civ for the first time on the console. Now with Ace Patrol, even though there's the expectation for the gameplay, not feeling the pressure to have so much time spent into it looking shiny as opposed to playing shiny.
Pretty big fan of Ace Patrol, and that when you played that game, you see Sid's fingerprints all over it. It's really elegant, straightforward, intuitive. It just has that magic to it that you go, gosh, I've allegedly been a game designer for 20 years, and then you come across someone like Sid or even Soren or Kale. You go, wow, these people are at a level that I can't even begin to approach. You just have a real appreciation. It's sort of like if you've ever been good at doodling, but then you meet a real artist, you really can appreciate what they do. And so when you see something like Ace Patrol, you go, wow, that is really well designed. There's also Sid Meier's Gettysburg, which I really wish they could bring that back. Have you guys ever played it?
I have a long time ago.
That would make a great iPad game, I think.
I could see that for sure.
The article goes towards what Brad's also been getting at, into Sid's recent and not-so-recent history. I think the first sentence is enough to get your attention to continue reading, which was, before Sid Meier was Sid Meier, he was just another computer hacker, which, the first thing I read that, and some people would be like, oh,
yeah,
that's naughty. How dare you, sir? Well, and there were some anecdotes here that you think, I've read everything that there is to be read publicly about Sid's earlier days, because there just aren't as many accounts of things that we're getting it from people who were there. You know, you didn't have the media attention or the documentation that you would have now. And there was this account of Sid playing Atari's Red Baron, and he was playing someone who was an Air Force pilot, and then he became a businessman, and Sid beat him. He doubled the guy's score. And today that person says, like, how did you outfly me? How did you do that? And Sid's like, well, while you were playing, I memorized the algorithm.
Yeah, that's how he met Wild Bill Steely. And, yeah, from the Kotaku article, it talks about that in the early 80s. He was just a 20-something-year-old programmer at General Instruments Corporation. One guy was playing the game, that would be Wild Bill, and the other guy was memorizing the pattern of the AI that he's fighting against and just went up there. And it's kind of like the guy who plays Pac-Man. I don't know if you guys played a lot of Pac-Man in your youth, but who are playing the game like playing it, and then you have the guy who knows the pattern. And he knows where the ghosts are going to go because he's memorized the pattern. Sid was at MicroProse, and then from the article, and eventually Spectrum Holobot bought MicroProse. And I think down the line, it got bought by Hasbro, which then sold it to Infogrames, which was rebranded. When MicroProse was in the process of going under, Sid Meier and Brian Reynolds and Jeff Briggs
left MicroProse and they called their new company Firaxis.
And then Infogrames renamed themselves to Atari.
Yeah.
And during all that time, Firaxis was ultimately in late 2005 purchased by 2K.
And that brings us up to present, where he's still there. He's the head of the studio and designing games and getting the program. He's living the dream.
You know, he does say that. He says, I'm doing what I want to do. I've been retired for a long time. I still love making games, so I've never really thought of quote-unquote retirement. Yes!
It's a good thing.
This is good news for us all. So say we all.
Yes.
He's going to make a Battlestar Galactica game next? What?
Towards the end, I don't ever remember Sid commenting on this. I don't remember anyone asking him this, at least that ever made it into print or otherwise. Does Sid ever worry that his games could have a harmful effect on people's lives? Might have something to do with this addiction thing with regards to Civilization. I like this answer. It's up with any other form of entertainment. It's up to the player or parents to decide what's appropriate and what's not appropriate.
Yeah.
Our goal is to make the games as fun as we can make them. I think that seems to be what most people are looking for. Well done. That's an excellent answer. It's not my responsibility if you find yourself addicted to the game.
It's not
the
his only fault answer. You're still up at 3 in the morning.
But he didn't say we couldn't blame him regardless, so I guess we're covered on both accounts.
I don't have anything clever to say to that.
Me neither.
I can't even believe that people would seriously ask him the question. It's ridiculous.
I believe it.
Certainly dating ourselves talking about Usenet and Pac-Man, but since I remember them too, I'm not going to, you know, throw in any criticism.
Hey, shall we reminisce about Gopher? No, okay, let's not.
Bye, Dave!
So as we've been doing for the past weeks, hey, guys, there were some more Q&A questions. Ooh. Over on the 2K blog yet again. First question, is France the only old Civ that has been revamped, or are there changes in other Civs as well? And if so, would you mind sharing or hinting at any of the changes? The answer on that one was that nothing has been dramatically as revamped as France, but we'll see subtler changes to India and Arabia, to name a few. And they were finding that some Civs, specifically they mentioned Polynesia, Rome, and Carthage, have been indirectly strengthened by new systems in Brave New Worlds.
So, in short, then, Polynesia, Rome, and Carthage are not changing?
Yeah, they're not changing.
Polynesia's strength's quite obvious.
Now, see, Rome was John's favorite of the Civs. He spent a lot of time working on Augustus there, and he explained the theme, why it's so depressing.
John Schaefer, the lead designer on Vanilla Civ 5, right.
All right, another question. Are there any ideology-specific wonders in the game? Each ideology has a wonder associated with it. Once the wonder is built, nobody else can build it. Of course, you could have given us an example. That would have been great. Like, if Dan takes honor, he builds the Great Wall, and then nobody else can build it.
Why does everyone keep bringing up the Great Wall in relation to me? I mean, there's no connection between those two things at all. I'm going to cry in the corner.
I'm sorry.
Yeah, me too. That corner's for me.
Well, we knew that certain social policies would unlock the ability to build particular wonders, so it makes sense that there are some wonders that's tied to an ideology as well, because that's really just an extension of the social policy system. They live in tandem.
Let's see. Any more new luxuries or non-Indonesian new luxuries? Nope. All the same. No bonus resources either. Oh, an elaboration on Indonesia's ability. The first three times they found a city on a brand new continent where they haven't founded a city before, they get two copies of a special resource, nutmeg, cloves, or pepper. Oh, more spices. The resource cannot be raised or destroyed, and Indonesia has the option to trade any of those if it wishes.
So it's kind of their equivalent of a mercantile city-state's porcelain or jewelry.
Yeah.
Just to clarify that answer further, because the Q&A asked for an elaboration on Indonesia's ability, and if you hadn't read from another source, you might think as soon as Indonesia gets their capital, then they get two copies of a special resource. No, that's...
Brand new continent.
But technically, see, the first time that you...
Yes, we start the game with brand...
You start... It's a new continent, right?
And you are founding a city.
Small island change.
Brand new continent, but it's like your starting continent. There we go.
I've never been a big fan of those sort of bonuses. Like, Polynesia's is possible, because at least you can still do something remotely with it. But with Indonesia, it's just like, you have to actively found a city on an island in order to get any benefit whatsoever. It's just, no.
But I've seen it on Pangaea before, or even just continents, where you've got little islands off the side that have some good resources.
It can happen.
Yep.
It can happen, but it's...
Especially Pangaea Plus.
There's no guarantee that those sites will be really worth going for. I suppose it does depend on whether the quote-unquote optimum strategies in Civ 5 have changed. Four cities, anyone?
No, Venice.
The final question from the Q&A.
Yeah, what is the how the hell do you say this?
Caravansary?
Something. But what does it do? Whoever was asking is asked, I'd be correct in assuming that the East India Company is the Associated National Wonder. And the unit I can't pronounce is a classical Arab building that improves the range and gold yield of land trade routes heading out of a city. East India Company is the National Wonder, replacing the National Treasury that's associated with having markets in every city. So its effect is pretty much the reverse, providing a boost to the routes coming into the city. So I guess ideally, if you had could get both, you could build them both in the same city, like your capital, and you would have so much gold, it wouldn't be funny.
You can be Scrooge McDuck.
I can't believe they called it East India Company.
Yeah, well, be super exalted as India.
Yeah, I know. That's just like, what the hell? Call it Trading Company, at least. Don't call it East India. Come on.
Just because that's more instantly recognizable to people who know a little bit of history, which is most of the players.
Call in today. In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659. That's 44-121-288-POLY.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast, Revcast, and Turncast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Civ 6 is going to be tough to do, I mean, because graphically, Civ 5 is actually pretty good. It has a DirectX 10 level engine.
It's quite clear that Civ 6 will be set in virtual reality.
Yeah.
The Oculus.
Second one.
You get to play.
I'm sure we'll get a Civ 6. I just think there'll be more expansions to Civ 5.
Will Civ 6 be a first-person shooter?
Extreme diplomacy!
Yes, an MMO. There you go.
You play as Gandhi or Lincoln, and your weapons are determined by basically who you pick.
So Gandhi gets nuked.
Yeah, there you go.
No, in Civ 6, you have all of these sensors you have to put on your body, and then you actually have to act out each combat.
What, it's going
to
be on the Xbox One?
Oh, no.
Oh, Mackie.
I'm going to buy the Xbox One anyway, so don't worry about that.
Thank you for joining us on episode 176, H-Rocks. Travis.
Rest in peace, Matt Osborne.
Makalua.
Yeah, I need more caffeine to deal with you people.
Daniel.
You are all my sunshine.
John.
Well, thanks for having me. I'll be back, no doubt.
Brad.
There's no coffee where I'm staying up north. No coffee.
No humming.
Me and team.
You are not a theremin.
Everything about me is working as intended.
I'll pass around the brain bleach for everyone. Father of Civilization. Seeing as how that's an article about a game developer, it seems appropriate that another game developer should introduce that.
Well, I guess I could do that.
Excuse me. Yeah, that was my segue. Look at that. That's you, Brad.
What? Are we talking about?
Oh, no, I put him to sleep.
Oh, yes.
Money. It's kind of funny in a rich man's world. And now we had the requisite song lyric reference, and it seems appropriate that Mackie introduce the next topic after a song lyric.
So I can tell you to stop singing and lyricing?
As long as it gets you to talk more, Mackie, I'm all for it.
That's not a great way to get me to talk, Dan.
You're still talking, I still win.
But it's not good content.
How about this?
I don't think
you don't have.
He doesn't care about negative attention.
We will have the sing off. How about that?
Women.
Don't make me hang up on this call.
Aw, no. Don't go breaking my heart.
Really? You can't just off it at the Wayback Machine for that one. Well, the continuing theme.
I forget, what did we do in 175? We talked about Civ!
It must have been memorable.
And I would never guess.
Record day, June 29th, 2013. Civilization 4 and 5 sound clips, copyright Take-Two Interactive. Copyright Civilized Communication at civcom.net.